Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. The Everything Financial Radio Program is brought to you each week by PLP Services. I have a couple of terrific guests lined up to talk about the economy and the markets and what it might mean for you and your money. Joining me momentarily is Mish Shedlock. Mish is the prolific economic commentator and writer that you'll find at mishtalk.com. Also joining me on today's program, Mr. Andrew Horowitz. Mr. Horowitz is a market commentator as well. We'll get his take on where the markets might be headed. Before I get to my interview with Ms. Shedlock, though, I'd like to invite you to participate in a free resource that we have available here in West Michigan. We have some Social Security maximization workshops coming up, the last ones of the year, actually. And if you're between the ages of 55 and 66, and you'd like to know if you're maximizing your Social Security benefits or would like to discover strategies to potentially help you maximize your benefits from Social Security, I'd like to invite you to attend one of our free workshops. All the workshops begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. Consequently, they do fill up quickly. On Tuesday, October 18, we'll be at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant. On November the 8th, out at Sunnybrook Country Club in Granville. And November 10, we'll be down in Byron Center at the 84th Street Pub and Grill. If you'd like to register or get more information, just visit the website socialsecurityradio.com. The website, again, is socialsecurityradio.com. I'm very pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Mike Mish Shedlock. If you don't read Mish's blog, you're missing out. You can go to mishtalk.com and check it out. He is a prolific writer, researcher, and all-around bright and even nice guy. So, Mish, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, some people might question that latter comment about me being a nice guy. But thanks, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, terrific. Well, Mish, let's talk about it. We've got an election coming up here, and one of the big indicators often, or I guess one of the big things that people consider when they go to the polls is how their pocketbook feels, which relates to, you know, how is the economy. What's your assessment?
I did a post on my blog that it really doesn't matter who's elected. The economy is in trouble. The global economy is in trouble. Protectionism is on the rise, and people point to, you know, Trump's wall. You know, let's be serious here. He's not going to get a wall. The Mexico's not going to build it for us, and Congress isn't going to fund it, which means that he's not going to get a wall. On the other hand, Hillary is in favor of this idea of having some sort of U.S. global trade prosecutor, you know, to go after a company. Now, that's something she can do. And I've done this before. I went back and I took statements actually from Bernie Sanders, from Hillary Clinton, and from Donald Trump, and I posted them on my blog. It was about 50 questions, I recall, or 50 comments. And I said, you know, if you think there's a difference between these, then tell me who made these various statements. And I couldn't even get them right, you know, if I went back and were to take them now, take the quiz now. They all, the global economy, politicians in the global economy are increasingly becoming trade isolationists. That is a very bad thing. I'm a firm believer in the free markets, but that's not the way we're heading, and a global trade slowdown with that is coming, and global trade slowdowns and wars often go together.
Well, Mish, you know, if you go back and look at what happened in the early 1930s, there was the same sentiment. You had the mm-hmm. same isolationist movements, protectionist mm-hmm. Policies. And it seems that these cycles repeat themselves. And doesn't that really exacerbate the very problem that they're trying to solve? I mean, the economy's weak. The last thing you need to do is go to a protectionist policy.
Yeah, here's what they're saying. We need to save jobs wherever. Every country says they need to save jobs. So, you know, the U.S. puts a steel tariff on China, and the EU does the same. And Manuel Valls came out today. That's the Prime Minister of France. And you know, he said, well, you know, we need to kill this trade deal, you know, that we have between the EU and the United States. The EU trade deal with Canada is on the rocks. The UK is going to have to renegotiate its trade deals with the EU. And Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the EC, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, both are out to punish, and they've even said this, they've used that word, the UK for leaving so that others don't leave. You know, if you have to force everyone to be in your gang, because that's what it is, a gang of 27, then... No, is there really a benefit to being in that gang? So trade is increasingly looking suspect everywhere, and that's a bad thing. Well, just look at cars. Germany exports a lot of cars to both the United States and to Europe, and vice versa. There are things that Europe imports from us and things Europe imports from the EU. What's going to happen here is they're going to say, okay, Europe's going to say, well, wait, we're going to, because you left, we're going to impose a tariff on your goods. How is the UK going to respond? We're going to impose the tariffs on their goods. Well, what's going to happen? GDP has to go down because cross-border trade goes down.
Well, Mish, when you take a look at, you know, the Brexit vote with Britain leaving the Eurozone, you immediately saw the British pound weaken. I think I read that it was at a 30 or 31 year low.
Yeah.
And the number one performing stock market index this year is, not surprisingly, the FTSE. So, you know, isn't this just kind of a game of changing the metric? I mean, let's make our currencies weak so our exports temporarily get stronger, our stock market looks better. But there's got to be an end game to this. What is it?
Well, everyone wants to do that, and mathematically, it's impossible. I don't think the UK set out with this as being the goal, but it certainly was the result. But in Europe, ECB President Mario Draghi is complaining about the strength of the euro, even though it's fallen dramatically versus the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is high, and we're complaining, and we're complaining because the Chinese yuan has fallen, and the Japanese yen, they're complaining about the strength of that, even though it's fallen dramatically over the last few years in aggregate. It's just risen recently, and Japan talks about one-sided moves, when the one-sided move was actually in the other way, lower for a very long period of time. Now it's going back the other way, and Japan doesn't like it. So the math of it is, it's very simple. Every currency cannot fall relative to everyone. They can fall relative to something, and they have been falling for most of this year, falling relative to gold. Gold is up pretty much in every currency this year. So it's given some of that back lately on belief that the Fed is going to hike. Dennis, are they going to hike? I don't know. Look at GDP estimates. The Atlanta Fed model has 2.1% for third quarter. The New York Fed model has 2.2% for the third quarter and 1.3% for the fourth quarter. We will have had six consecutive quarters of where five of them have been under 2%, and the Fed's supposed to hike. So maybe they should hike because we've certainly got an asset bubble, but this is not the way they think. The Fed doesn't think we have an asset bubble. So December's likely to be quite interesting. Now, there's a couple of key ports coming out later this week on retail sales. If that number is poor, we're going to see these odds of a rate hike now close to 75% crash.
Well, I want to talk about the asset bubble, but I'm going to have to do that in the next segment. The good news is Mish will be hanging around for one more segment, and we'll get to our conversation with him in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Thanks for listening today. And if you'd like to go back and listen to any of the interviews that we do with our guest experts here on the program, we have a website where you can do just that. Visit everythingfinancialradio.com, and you can listen to any of our past interviews at your convenience. I'm chatting today with Mr. Mike Mish Shedlock. I would encourage you to check out his blog at mishtalk.com. You can also just Google Mish, M-I-S-H, and he will be, from my experience, the number one search result. So I'd encourage you again to check that out. Mish, you know, we talked about the fact in the last segment that we've seen GDP growth that is very, very anemic. You really recently in your blog talked about some recession indicators, and I thought it was a great post. Maybe share it with the listeners.
It's something I just came up with, and I wish I would have come up with it earlier. Now, I get accused a lot of predicting a perpetual recession. That's not true at all. And in fact, I caught the bottom in March of 2009 on the nose. Now, I got bearish on the stock market way too early, so obviously I don't get everything right here. But around 2012, I started talking about recession, and I wasn't the only one. The ECRI started talking about the possibility of a recession, too. And, you know, they missed a call. But recently I was looking at some indicators. We have one called gross domestic income. And we've got another one called private domestic investment. And the private domestic investment is a percentage of GDP, but a very volatile one. A lot of GDP is government spending, and that is a very stable thing. But business investment, which accounts for private business investment, which accounts for only about 14% of GDP or so, is actually very volatile. Are businesses investing or not? And the other side of the equation is income. Are people making, you know, more money in real terms, in inflation-adjusted terms, you know, than they have been? Because if people are making more money, guess what, Dennis? They have a tendency to spend it, right? So what I did was I said, let's look at these two indicators together, income and private investment, and they've each given a number of false signals, you know, over the last 40, 50 years, in terms of where one of them would be negative. But I went back and looked, and I said, typically when we were in recession, both of them were negative. And so I went back in a series of 10 years and just looked at 10-year periods, and I said, okay, in which of these periods did this work? And from 1947 to 1956, there were two recessions. Both of them started precisely when both of those indicators went negative. And the same thing in 1956 to 66, the indicators went negative slightly before the recessions. And I just went through this by every decade. And currently, right now, just this last month, these two indicators are both in the red again. So, and that hasn't happened here for quite a while. There was a false signal actually right around the time in third quarter of 2012 when a couple of us thought we were heading for a recession. It didn't happen, and those indicators quickly, you know, reversed and within one quarter and went back green. They might do the same thing again. So there's no indicators here that are infallible, but this provides another look, at least, at how weak the economy is. And if we've got real incomes falling, and if we've got business investment falling at the same time, it's a pretty weak economy, don't you think?
I would agree. And, Mish, I want to get, well, we have time. I want to talk about, you mentioned in the last segment that we are, in your view, undoubtedly in an asset bubble. Mm-hmm. I would certainly agree. Give me your take on stocks and then real estate.
I think real estate, they've reblown an echo bubble here, starting with that. But it's widely varied. Some places, you know, didn't recover that much. Take a look at Central Illinois, places like Danville. Well, you know, where a lot of people live in the Farm Belt, the bubble was not reblown in those areas. In fact, around Danville, there was never a bubble in the first place. But places like San Francisco, they've reblown it. But pretty much back in 2006, 2007, vast majority of the country was in a huge real estate bubble. Now only select portions, but it's some of the bigger cities, California, San Francisco, other places, and it's slowing a lot in places that are tied to oil because oil has been in a slump. So it's not as pervasive, but they've reblown it in some areas. As for the stock market and the bond market, when three-quarters of the world's bonds trade with negative interest rates, what can you possibly call that but a bubble? When bonds trade at negative interest rates, that is saying you would rather have 90 cents a year from now than a dollar today. Mathematically, that is actually crazy. It's impossible in the real world. It's only possible when central banks are doing coordinated quantitative easing in a competitive currency devaluation scheme on the belief that if they can prop up the stock market, they can get people to spend. So we've got median PEs on the S&P 500 at an all-time high. They're higher than they were in the 2000 dot-com bubble. That's pretty amazing. Now that's the median PE. The point at which half of the PEs are above and below has never been as high as it is now. The aggregate PE was actually higher in the dot-com bubble and higher, I think, in 1929 than it is now. But we are talking about the third or fourth or second, even first, depending on which metric you want to use, stock market valuation in history. It doesn't mean there's necessarily going to be a crash. This can go on for a while. A lot of people expected things to crash this year. They didn't. But, you know, what we do know is, historically speaking, this is a very bad time to be in the stock market. So there's nothing wrong with cash here, in my opinion. And there's nothing wrong with a little insurance or a lot of insurance, depending on your point of view, for holding something like gold on the belief that central banks simply don't have everything under control.
Well, one would have to think that there is a high likelihood that they don't. So, Mish, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been great to have you on the program. It's amazing how fast two segments pass.
Yeah,
if I can
get in one more comment, Dennis. There,
a quick one.
I believe the rise in gold is directly tied to increasing lack of faith that central banks have everything under control. So I would ask people to think about that.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Thanks for joining us today, Mish.
Thanks, Dennis.
And in case you're just joining us, let me remind you of some free resources we have available here in the West Michigan area. If you're between the ages of 55 and 66, I'd like to invite you to attend our Social Security Maximization Workshops. We've got three more remaining this year. Tuesday, October 18th, will be at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant out on 28th Street. On November the 8th, we'll be at Sunnybrook Country Club. And on November the 10th, 84th Street Pub and Grill. You can get more information or register while capacity remains by visiting the website socialsecurityradio.com. Socialsecurityradio.com is the website, and at the event, all events incidentally begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. You may learn how to increase your Social Security benefits by as much as 32% and how to collect a free spousal benefit even if you're divorced. Again, the website, socialsecurityradio.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you're listening in today. Hey, if you're not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, there's no reason not to be. The Portfolio Watch newsletter is free. It is delivered every Monday via email. You get it at 5 p.m. after market close. And it gives you our take on what's going on in the economy and the markets, and gives you some additional thoughts for consideration on managing your own money. If you'd like to become a subscriber, again, it is free. All you need to do is visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com. That website is your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. And all you have to do is give us your name and email address, and you are a subscriber, and the following Monday, in your inbox, you'll get your very own copy of Portfolio Watch. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Mr. Andrew Horowitz. Andrew is the president and founder of Horowitz & Company. He also hosts the podcast, which airs weekly, titled The Disciplined Investor, a very popular podcast. He is returning to the program for his second visit. And Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dennis, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Great show.
Well, let's, Andrew, first talk a bit about how banking is kind of sneaking its way back into the headlines. I thought Dodd-Frank was supposed to fix all this.
Yeah, right. Wasn't everything supposed to be just, well, we had a problem and that's never going to happen again. But there's a couple of things that are interesting, I think, that are happening. And some of them here in the U.S. and some of them not in the U.S. The first thing, obviously, that we have to look at is this whole mess with Wells Fargo. Clearly, there is something that went wrong, and I think a couple of things that were really interesting is that, first of all, there was years and years of some kind of program going on where there was a they were looking to increase the amount of accounts. 2 million accounts were opened. Some of them were by employees who opened up for current customers without their knowledge. Some were for people that just didn't even exist. And one of the things that Wells Fargo had going for it all those years and why they had a premium to other banks was because they had so many more accounts per client. So we now know where that came from. So 2 million accounts, this isn't like, oh, somebody opened up 5 accounts or 6 accounts. This is a majorly widespread situation that happened, and probably the worst thing that Wells Fargo could have done was to announce this and come out with this during the presidential and the political campaign season, because now they are going to be ground zero for attacks. And so the problem is, as you mentioned, there was all these things that were supposed to protect consumers, and already we're seeing that there's a major hole in that. And I don't even think that this is, I don't think there's a possibility that this kind of approach and this kind of situation was only at Wells Fargo. It doesn't seem logical if it was that widespread that it wasn't done at other places. Now, there wasn't a lot of money that was lost by people. There wasn't a lot of fines that have been imposed right now. However, the fact is that it does really break the spirit and trust of people that we're working with some of these big banks. So I think we have something brewing here, at least from a trust factor of the banks right now, that we're just recently we're starting to, you know, come back to, okay, well, maybe this is a better time, maybe the banks are better, but there's still a lot of shenanigans going on. I think you would agree.
Yeah, I would agree. And Andrew, you know, for our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with this story, could you just go and just give them the basic, you know, fundamental overview of what exactly happened?
Yeah, so for about a two-year period approximately, Wells Fargo, there was a group of employees that were opening up accounts, checking accounts, savings accounts, for people without their knowledge, charging them fees on some of the accounts, maybe taking it from different accounts, and opening up accounts for people that didn't even exist. Now, this was the other problem was that over the years they were firing people for these kinds of practices, and I think a total of about 5,000 people were in fact fired over the years due to this. But again, it wasn't something that stopped until very recently, only a few weeks ago, when they came out with this. So you have multiple problems here. You have the fact that there was lack of disclosure of some of this going on over the last few years. You had this in a widespread and a manner that was not just a one-off. So it was entire departments, because they were getting the employees were getting bonuses on their opening up of accounts. So you have all these accounts going on and opening up, and you have all this happening without the knowledge of the individual and consent without consent of the client. And this is really just a very bad situation. Like I said, it's only about maybe $15 or $20 million, which is a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot of money, of fees that were taken back, which were refunded. And the other thing that's happening is now there's clawbacks on the executives. There's requests by Congress, who is looking into this deeply, to have people, clawbacks they call it, where the CEO and managers will take their bonuses and send them back and have to relieve themselves of anything they made because of this. And on top of that, cities and states are now pulling out of their relationships with Wells Fargo. So this is a really bad situation. And one thing that's interesting is the biggest supporter and the biggest investor in Wells Fargo for many, many years, and the biggest advocate and fan, has been Warren Buffett, who has not said a thing about this. Very interesting how this whole thing has played out over time. Wells Fargo's stock is down significantly due to the fact of not only this, but also some of the back-end features that are happening with what's called the yield curve, where we have a very low slope, where the front-end or the short-term bonds, due to the Fed pushing down rates, is very low, and the long-term bonds are not that high. Therefore, they're loaning money and they're giving, making money on that, but that they're paying out in savings, and those numbers are not helping their earnings. So there's a lot of things happening in the banking industry in the U.S. is a problem, which, by the way, is not that big of a deal compared to what's going on in Europe.
Well, I was just going to go there, Andrew, and if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Andrew Horowitz. He is the president and founder of Horowitz & Company, also the host of the popular podcast, The Disciplined Investor. You know, if you look at what's going on in Europe, I mean, arguably Italian banks are fundamentally insolvent. I mean, to fill the listeners in there, and what are you predicting?
Well, one of the problems that has happened, I think that I'll describe this rather in a grotesque manner, that can really give you a overview of really what happened here. So in the U.S., when the whole banking crisis happened, the financial disaster back in mid-2000s, the U.S. really went very aggressively to recapitalize banks and to do what they can from a regulatory standpoint to make sure these banks would, in fact, hold up, their balance sheets were recapitalized, et cetera. In Europe, what they did was something different. It's kind of like where you have a giant something that looks like a big ice cream cone with one of those hard chocolate layers over the top. You've seen these, right?
Absolutely. They're delicious.
But the problem is the ECB, or European Central Bank, put this coating over the top. Unfortunately, underneath it is not chocolate ice cream. It's dog poop. So they covered this up, and taking a bite of that is not good. So once you get through that crust, which was the protection they put over, and this guise of fixing the banks was this chocolate icing, if you will, and below it was really still the same fundamental problems. As you mentioned, insolvency or liquidity problems, they didn't really provide any regulatory benefit. The balance sheets are still a disaster. They still have a lot of bad debt. And you look at the banks around that area, whether it's Portugal or Italy, and even the greatest banks that we thought were really going to do well, like a Deutsche Bank, by the way, which hit an all-time low recently. All-time. I'm not talking about a low of 2007, 2008. I'm talking about an all-time low, because they have had some very bad misdealings in the currency markets. They have actually been now fined $14 billion by the U.S. for their part in the financial crisis back in the 2000s. And now Italy is going after them for what they did, seemingly to pretty much put Banco Monte Paschi out of business, the biggest bank in Italy. So it's coming from all ends, not to mention the Volkswagen scandal. This is all kind of very Germany-centric here, which we thought was a great economy, the best economy in Europe, has really have a lot of things that are questionable that are going on, and particularly in their banks. And as we've seen the Deutsche Bank scandal and the realization that they have the potential for needing a recapitalization, we're seeing that banks around the world, as well as markets around the world, are really reacting pretty violently because of the fact that this is a major bank that, if it does in fact have to have some kind of a bailout, or if it goes under, is going to be very bad for everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, Deutsche Bank's had a lot of credibility problems. They were they admitted that they had a role in rigging the price of gold and silver as well, as you'll recall. So, I mean, this whole credibility issue with banks is going to be a big headline moving ahead. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for this segment to chat with Andrew Horowitz. That's the bad news. The good news is Andrew will be back when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program, brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you're listening in today. Hey, if you're between the ages of 55 and 66 and you want to make sure that you've looked at every option when it comes to maximizing the income you collect from Social Security, I'd like to invite you to visit the website socialsecurityradio.com and check out the information that is there. There you'll find information about our Social Security Maximization Workshops, which are free. They begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. We have three left for this year. Tuesday, October 18th, will be at Nodo's Old World Italian Restaurant out on 28th Street. Tuesday, November 8th, will be at Sunnybrook Country Club out in Granville. Thursday, November 10th, we will be out in Byron Center at the 84th Street Pub and Grill. Again, all the meetings begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. You will learn how to coordinate Social Security with your personal savings and investments. We'll talk about what the future of Social Security might be. We'll talk about how to potentially avoid paying tax on your Social Security benefits, how to get a free spousal benefit, and how to potentially increase Social Security benefits by as much as 32%. The website again, socialsecurityradio.com, to register or get more information. I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with Andrew Horowitz. Andrew is the president and founder of Horowitz & Company. He's also the host of the podcast, The Disciplined Investor. And, you know, we spent some time in the last segment, Andrew, talking about banking, and let's broaden our conversation a bit in this segment, and let's just talk about the state or health of the worldwide economy. Give the listeners your assessment.
Well, there's very different levels of the economic growth that are happening around the world. So right now we are still seeing that Japan is mired in a deflationary spiral, even though the Bank of Japan has been doing everything they could possibly do with what they know to do, to try to bring interest rates down, to try to spur on the economy. That's a big problem, especially because their currency, the yen, has been rising dramatically, up about 17% this year so far. Europe is still slogging along. We have seen a turnaround in emerging markets, by the way, and that was due to the fact that the dollar came down, commodities came up, and all these natural resource, commodity-based economies have been doing much better. And the U.S., from the perspective of employment and the perspective of just general manufacturing and overall real estate, et cetera, has been probably the best of all of them. And that's why a lot of money is moving over here. The problem is going to be a renewed concern if, in fact, we continue to see the dollar moving higher, bond yields in the U.S. moving higher. This is going to be a problem for many of the countries around the world that are continuing their negative interest rates, which, by the way, probably is one of the single most worst moves that central banks have made in the last 50 years. They unfortunately thought that, well, if low interest rates are good, well, lower interest rates are better. And if lower interest rates are better, well, how about we go so far as to go negative interest rates? And they thought that that would push a lot of money out and into the economy, into loans, into capital spending. It didn't. It's being hoarded. People are very concerned about this, and they made a very tactical mistake in doing this. And we have that in a variety of countries, but namely in Europe and in Japan. So while our interest rates may be on the uptick here in the U.S. as they're trying to normalize, the Fed is trying to normalize rates. They talked about a one rate increase at the end of this year, possibly two next year. Very slow. But we are seeing a little bit of a concern now and problems that are cropping up, for example, in our manufacturing index, which recently came in a little bit better, a services index, which did come in better but had been slowing down significantly. And when we look at the import-export, and then on top of that, you know, just to kind of throw this in there, the economics are really up in the air because we're right in the middle of a very interesting presidential election cycle, and both sides have very different ways of approaching the economies. One is going to Donald Trump trying to redo all sorts of trade deals, and we're not sure how that's going to play out. Hillary Clinton's more of the same from all aspects, although she's going to be attacking the banks and the biotechs and healthcare industry. So there's a lot of things that are kind of a lot of moving parts right now, not to mention the Fed, who's in play right now through the end of the year in 2017. So the economy, I think generally, confidence is there. Building in the U.S. has been better, and residential sales have been generally holding up pretty well. Housing prices in most areas have been holding up. There's been some slowdowns in the higher-end pricing of housing throughout the country. But one of the big things that's happening also is we're seeing that oil has turned around and started to move higher. That will help out areas in the North Dakota and Midwest. It will help out Pennsylvania and some of the East Coast on the Northeast, and also Texas. And some of the other areas that are oil producing. So there's kind of a bit of a change going on, whereas commodities are helping along a lot of areas. That may start to push inflation up, though, and that may, in fact, cause the interest rates to move a little bit faster to the upside.
You know, when you mentioned Japan in a deflationary cycle, and they've tried, as you said, just about every trick in a central banker's book to stop the deflationary cycle. And when you look at private sector debt levels there, not to mention public debt, but look at the comparison to the U.S., our private sector debt levels are very high. Can we ultimately escape deflation, or are we just a little bit behind Japan as far as where we are in this progression, in your view?
It looks like one of the biggest problems with Japan has been the demographic shift over the last 50 years, where they have an aging population, a lack of immigration, and we've seen a lot of that here as well. We have also this whole massive group of young people, the millennials, who have a much different spending patterns and desire for objects, material items, than the last few generations had. So that's kind of changing things also. So we have a demographic shift here as well. It seems to me, and the funny thing is, that we watched what Japan did over the last 20 or so years unsuccessfully in terms of trying to get their inflation up or stop deflation and move their economy up. And it didn't work at all. But what did we do? We followed along in exactly the same pattern and same modes and methods that they used. And this is not only here, it's around the world. So the race to the bottom from a currency's perspective is what is desirous, it seems, to help exports. But because the world is so globally integrated now versus when it was even just 20 years ago, it seems like this whole thing is going to just make a gigantic cycle around to every country out there, particularly those that have aging populations and a change in the spending patterns. And I just don't see how we can escape that. It almost looks like we are trapped in, or we're turning Japanese song would say, right? We're turning Japanese in terms of our economic policies and the prospect of our economic future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, Andrew, in the time we have left, let's talk about U.S. stock market indices. Margin debt's up there. Price-earnings ratios are up there. Are we going to see the crash that so many analysts have been predicting for such a long time now?
It would seem to me that I agree with you on margin levels, that we've really approached escape velocity with margin levels again, which is the borrowing of money to buy stocks on loan. We've also seen that the corporate debt is at the highest ever Now, you say, well, okay, corporate debt is high, but the yield and the amount they're paying on the debt, servicing costs are lower. However, the problem is that because they have so much debt, their debt servicing is still very high. And if we continue to see revenue slowdowns and earnings slowdowns, we've seen five consecutive quarters of earnings growth to the negative side, it would seem to me that we're going to have a problem. P.E. ratio and pricing of stocks, there's definitely some very elevated levels here. The one thing that I could say, and I agree with halfway, is that as long as interest rates are very low, that can be sustained. Because you also have buybacks that are going on from the companies issuing debt and buying back their shares, which has been a major part of this underpinning of this market. However, as rates go up, that's all going to change. And all of this that we've seen recently is out the window, and now we're going to have to readjust back to normal levels in terms of P.E. ratios and in terms of valuations.
Well, let me get your take on moving ahead, Andrew. Do you have an opinion on where gold prices might go?
I mean, if the dollar continues to move higher, I think there's going to be a situation where gold starts to leak back down. I mean, we saw some very, very severe, a couple of weeks back, we saw some very severe moves on gold and silver with the fact that the dollar starts to turn around very significantly ahead of the Fed possibly raising rates November or December. Gold was bought significantly by central banks for some time. It would seem to me that with all that's going on and the central banks requiring excess cash to throw in the economy, they're not going to be the big buyers anymore. Jewelry sales are down significantly. And again, if we're counting on jewelry sales, for example, in China or maybe in India, which are big buyers of gold, we have to look at their economies. And then in the U.S., again, back to the millennials, they're just not buying that kind of stuff. That's not their thing. So I'm not sure where gold gets its boost unless, one, there is some weird event that happens, clearly some very significant economic or geopolitical event that goes on, or, in fact, if the dollar comes down and you see that there is that equation where, dollar down, gold up. But, gold I was kind of really excited about for a while. The miners have had some big problems of late, and I just don't see the real catalyst right now at this moment, just right at this moment, for gold doing anything but stabilizing at these basic levels.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Andrew Horowitz. He is the president and founder of Horowitz & Company. Also, you want to catch his podcast titled The Disciplined Investor. Andrew, thank you for being here and love to have you back.
Hey, thanks. Always a pleasure, Dennis. Anytime.
Well, thanks for listening in this week. We will be back again next week, and joining me on next week's program will be a couple of really great special guests. I'll have joining me Mr. John Kay. I caught up with Mr. Kay in London this past week, and also Mr. Carl Denninger. If you're not yet a subscriber to Portfolio Watch, let me remind you, it's a free newsletter delivered to your inbox every Monday at 5 p.m., All you have to do to become a subscriber is visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com. That's your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. That's our program for the week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.